So. So, 5:20. 20.
If you can be careful with this blackboard because it's rotating when you.
Okay, we'll try to fix it after if it doesn't. Okay, so I say that originally this Ponson Auger model is kind of an ill-defined quantity because it's full of infinities. But we have to think a bit more why there's such infinities. And you know, if you think about we're doing the integral of all possible metric there. But the proper measure of integration we should use if an action is a diffeo invariant is not the integral over all possible metric. I should not integrate over all possible metric, but I should integrate over all possible diffeomorphism class of metric. So I should divide by the volume, you know, formally of diffeomorphism. Okay? The proper way to do that when the volume is non-compact is by doing a gauge fixing, introducing Fayev Popov determinant, and so on. So the first question one should ask is, is there such a symmetry in my discrete action? The naive picture is that when you discretize a model, you break the symmetry. And it's true in general, when you discretize a model, you know, if you put an object on a lattice, then you break translational invariance, and you recover only discrete translational invariance. If you take a model which is diffeo invariance, you would expect that you break completely diffeomorphism invariance. But there might be a smart choice of action which is an optimal choice of action, where the symmetry is respected as much as you can. So there's a possibility that you put a lattice, but there is still a residual action of the diffeomorphism group at each level of your discretization. And if you can ensure that, then you're kind of sure that when you take the continuum limit, you're as close as possible to the true continuum theory. In 2 plus 1, the symmetry is so strong that you can show that explicitly. That is, after a few steps of the refinement procedure, that's it. You're there, and you are in the continuum theory. I want to insist that the previous amplitude I described, if the property I say is true, is a continuum theory. It's no longer a discrete theory. I've taken the continuum limit. There's no more any discretization scale there. It is a true continuum theory. I can compute the amplitude for any initial graph, any final graph, as fine as you want, as complicated as you want. Okay? So here. So the action was that. Well, this is a red. Let me try another one. So the action, sum over f, trace of xf, gf. Okay. So, and obviously this action has a Lorentz gauge symmetry. I'm trying to see whether it has a Lorentz gauge symmetry. And in the case of Euclidean gravity, that's why I work in Euclidean gravity, the Lorentz group is compact. So I don't really have to worry about, in my discretization, even if I don't gauge fix my Lorentz gauge symmetry, I can take care of it by taking a R measure which is normalized. So this is done. In the Lorentzian case, that's why it's more complicated, and that's why I don't talk about it, you will have to gauge fix also the Lorentzian part. But we know how to do it. So the other symmetry, if you remember, in the continuum is diffeomorphism symmetry, and diffeomorphism symmetry was equal on shell to translational symmetry. And translational symmetry was due to the fact that we had Bianchi identity, d omega of f omega is equal to zero. So we can start to ask, if there is a change that this action as a symmetry, it's because there should be some notion of Bianchi identity on my lattice. And there is a notion of Bianchi identity on the lattice. Suppose I take a collection of phase that form a bubble. Okay, so I take a bubble. So collection of phase that, you know, close onto a two-dimensional sphere like that. Suppose I choose a starting point, And I start to compute the holonomy around one face, and I go back. And then the holonomy around another face, and I go back, etc. And then I continue, always coming back from the point I started from. Then you see that at the end of the day, what I've done is going somewhere and coming back. This is the same as the big holonomy here. So if I continue and I imagine I'm a closed sphere, at some point, you know, I will multiply. So this object is represented by some product over all face belonging to a bubble of individual group elements, GF, right? But at some point, I'm going to close this bubble, and then this loop is contractible, so it's going to be equal to the identity. And that's a discrete Bianchi identity. That's the discretization of this object. Okay, so suppose I now take this identity, I multiply it by sigma, and I take the trace, I project it onto, you know, I project it onto my Lie algebra element. And then I define PFI to be the trace of GF sigma I. So I want to write this identity, it's a bit complicated because it's a multiplicative identity, so I want to write it really in terms of my momenta here. And what you can show is that the structure of this identity becomes an additive identity which has the following structure. So that now there is a certain set of coefficients that I call UBF, which are just scalar and depends on the holonomy. Okay, let me write what I mean there and I'm going to explain. It doesn't work? Yeah. If I throw everything away, everything will be gone. That's okay, this one I throw it away. This one is kind of okay, but if I stay with black. Do you have a black, a new black? Or you're
yes.
Just give it to me. I mean, it's if you're trying to save some money. It's one black.
Keep track of
this. Okay, I keep this one. Okay, so. Okay, so there is a collections of UBF, collections of elements which are just scalars. And here, omega BF are collections of elements which are in the Lie algebra. They are in the Lie FSU2. And they depend on, you know, in an explicit way, but not completely obvious way, in the structure of group element, such that this identity is written like that, the sum over all faces in the bubble. You know, P plus omega wedge P. Okay, so that it really looks a bit more like a covariant derivative acting on my momenta. So it's clear. I'm not going to detail what UB and omega is. It doesn't really matter for the argument, just the fact that this identity can be written like that when you project it onto the Lie algebra. So now if you define a notion of a variation F. So you assign a gauge transformation which is associated to bubbles, because we have seen that the problems come from bubbles. So that is, if I look at the face F, it belongs always to two different bubbles, bounded by two bubbles. In the dual triangulation pictures, just the fact that an edge, you know, has two vertex. I have a notion of gauge transformation, which is that I can transform delta of xf, labeled by this phi, to be just the sum over all bubbles which bound f, ubf of phi b minus omega bf of phi b. Okay, define this transformation, and then you can check that delta of s, delta phi of s, is equal to zero. So this transformation is a gauge symmetry, discrete gauge symmetry for my discrete action there. And this is a residual gauge symmetry, which is still there even after my discretization. And not every discrete action will have that, but this one has this discrete symmetry. The way you prove that is that you put that in the action, and you integrate by part, and then you recognize phi b times the Bianchi identity. In order to see what this symmetry means, if you go on shell, so let's say you put all the GF on shell means that there's no matter or no boundary. GF is the identity. U just become 1, and omega becomes 0. And then this symmetry just becomes delta of XF, so on shell. It's just phi B1 minus phi B2. So if I think in terms of edge, this is B1, this is B2, this is F. What I'm doing is that on shell I have a flat geometry, and I'm allowed to translate the vertex of my flat geometry as I want. Phi is like the position of my vertex. So it's clear why this is going to be, in some sense, a good symmetry, because on shell is telling me that suppose I have some label of pinch G1, G2, G3, G4, G5, and then I change the position of my vertex there, and I interpret G1 as being the length of this edge. Then after translating that, I'm going to have a spin network with or a vertex where the coloring are going to be G' 1, G' 5 here. But this translation doesn't change the geometry. I'm just discretizing the geometry, the same geometry in a different way. I'm not changing the geometry here. I'm just moving the labels, and this should be a, this is a, these two triangulations with different labels correspond to exactly the same flat geometry, so they should be identified. And we see that at the level of the action. Okay, so when we have a symmetry, the problem is that it's a non-compact symmetry. It's labeled by a Lie algebra element. Well, suppose you have a flat, a real flat triangulation in terms of tetrahedra. And then you look at one of these vertex of this triangulation. And then you suppose that each edge of this triangulation, you label each edge by the distance measured in this flat metric. Okay, L1, L2, L3. So if I give you collections of points in R3, I can give you corresponding Regé triangulation. Then if I just take this triangulation and move one vertex, it's not going to change the triangulation, but it's going to change the label on the triangulation because the edge lengths are going to change. But I'm not doing anything. I mean, this is the same geometry, the same global geometry. I'm just describing in a different manner the same object. This is just like a change of coordinate. I just move my vertex. If I move my vertex, the distance change. Right? Here it is. This is L1, L2, L3. If I move it, then you compute, and this is L1, L2, L3. Okay? The coloring are identified with the edge lengths. If it doesn't help you, then forget about this. It's supposed to help you, this geometrical picture. But so this is really the expression of coordinate invariance, if you want. That these spin labels that we think are real, not all of them are real. Okay, just certain combinations of them are real physical entities. Okay, so now we need to fix the gauge fixing. A natural gauge fixing in this context, I have an action, of a symmetry group at vertices. A natural way to gauge fix such object is to first do some kind of axial gauge, which means one. You choose first let's say I look at the triangulation picture. I have this collection of edge. I look now at a sub complex, which is formed by a collection of edge, which form a tree. Right. So I call. I need in order to gauge fix my data. I need to choose a tree of edges of my triangulation. Okay. And then I can use this gauge symmetry to show that I can fix the value of x, f, to be anything I like for all faces that are that belong to this tree. Okay. So here I'm moving from the picture in triangulation or picture in. So let's say here is a tree of edge, and in the dual picture it intersects face f1. Face F2, face F3. And then I can show that I can use this gauge symmetry to fix the value of x along this object. And this is exactly what you would do with an axial gauge. So a choice of tree Here, it's just the discrete analog of a choice of a vector field, because a tree is something which has, at each vertex, only one, you know, if you start from a root, there's only one direction at each vertex, so it's like a vector field. And the gauge fixing is just, the axial gauge fixing, which is the fact that you contract the metric along this vertex and you fix it to be any value you want, zero or whatever, you know, any, not zero, but any, you know, fixed metric here. Okay, so this is an axial gauge fixing in the discrete, and it can be even shown more, that is, you can prove property about other class, mathematical property, which really show that this tree is the right picture of a vector field in a discrete setting. And T, okay, so in order to be a good gauge fixing, it should be a tree, but it should be connected and maximal. Maximal means that it should go through every vertex, internal vertex of my triangulation, and touch only one vertex on the boundary. Okay, but these are technical conditions. Then I'm sure that I've gauge fixed all the symmetry of my theory. And then you can prove them. Okay, so then you do this gauge fixing. You have to compute the Fadeyev Popov determinant associated to this gauge fixing. It's not completely trivial, but somehow there's some simplification due to the dynamics. And at the end of the day, I'm not going to do the computation, but at the end of the day, you show that the corresponding model. So now you really, you know, start beginning, put your gauge fixing, choose a tree, choose a value x0f for each phase, and do your gauge fixing, and then do again the same computation from your discrete action. And then you can show that this is the sum over spins, which are fixed on the boundary, okay, product of f, dgf, as a product of vertex of my gf1, gf6. But now there's an additional observable, let's say, which is a gauge fixing observable that I have to include here. And this observable OT is just going to be the product of for all phase that belong to my tree of delta of GF, GF0. So, you know, my gauge fixing, so here it depends a priori on my coupling constant, my tree, and my choice of gauge fixing. And here, in the discrete case, the fixing x0, I fix the value of the spin. Okay. And what you can show now is that this object, the big theorem, is that this object is under a certain condition that I will maybe spell out in a second, finite and independent of S, T, and GF0. You see, the independence on T and GF0 is that it's called BRST invariance. If you do some gauge fixing, how do you know that you have done things properly, that there was a symmetry? You know that you have done things properly when changing the gauge fixing do not change anything, right? So you have to prove that this is true. And this amplitude then defined, because it's independence on the refinement and the choice of gauge fixing, defined this continuum phi theory amplitude. And for instance, you can show and this object is independent of S, T, F, and then finite. Well, you have to specify when you compute proper observable. And I'm not going to explain that, but there's a beautiful mathematical theory behind.
What is O?
This is this guy. OT of GF is if you want, what is OT of GF? Is delta, you know, it's my gauge fixing. I have let's say, you know, F of G. This is my gauge fixing variable, multiplied by my Fadeyev Popov determinant, right? So when I do a gauge fixing, it's just that I take the usual path integral and I insert a, you know, gauge fixing condition plus a Fadeyev Popov determinant. So this is what this object is in this context. And you need this df square to show that it doesn't depend on on the choice of tree. Okay, so now we have a definition of 2 plus 1 gravity for any boundary, for any state on the boundary, for any topology of the manifold, and we can go on and start to compute observable and do, you know, everything we can do. We have a full definition of the theory. One example is that if you start with a manifold which is of some sigma, you know, of a genus G across an interval, and you compute this object, phi gamma 1, phi gamma 0, you can show that this is the same as the integral. So if I have phi gamma 1, phi gamma 0, I can compute you know, spin network functional that depend on the connection, and I'm integrating over the moduli space of flat SU2 connection, right? And the moduli space of flat SU2 connection is a symplectic manifold, so there's a natural canonical measure, and then you can show this equivalence, that this object, which is discrete here, can be related to another object, which is continuous, that you can define mathematically independently, which is this integral of a moduli space of flat SU2 connection. Okay. Yes? The space of flat connection. Modulo gauge transformation. What? SU2 connection. On my surface. Okay?
And what is the measure?
The symplectic measure. This is a symplectic manifold, so you take the natural symplectic measure with a certain normalization that I won't specify here. Okay? It's a symplectic manifold, so there's a canonical measure. It's a phase space, so. Okay? I mean, it's not going to be, I mean, you know, I don't want to enter there because. I mean, behind these things, here I'm doing the physical description of that, but you can, you know, give a course on this model which doesn't mention any physics and just do the mathematics. And the mathematics is very interesting behind. There's the geometry of moduli space, knot invariance, and all that. But I'm not interested in that here. Yeah, you can prove that. So this is my definition. Because it's independent of that, then, you know, it doesn't depend on that. So that's a unique definition of a continuum phi theory that helped me to compute all possible invariants. And then it's not, okay, then you can show this transformation. In fact, it was shown a bit differently a long time ago by Oguri. Carlo used this type of transformation. But you can here really start from the full definition and also show that directly. So this is, let's say, if you want to, a theorem. I'm not saying it's completely obvious, but it should be. So what I want to do now is, okay, so we have seen the symmetry, we have seen the definition of the model, and the next thing now that we have, in some sense, a quantum geometry, what I call a quantum geometry is this model, this definition, is to be able to compute now natural observables. And in some sense, to me, this is the most interesting part of the story that is starting now, but I don't have much time to say a lot about. So let me try to give you a summary of that story. So what are the most interesting observables for physicists? Well, matter field, right? And or if I think in even, you know, more ancient way, well, particle. So if I have a space-time, what I can do, I can just, you know, throw a particle in it and look at how they move. And then, you know, that's from there that I'm going to say what type of geometry I'm having. So I want to insert matter now, insertion of matter. So we have seen in the beginning and also in ambient lecture that the Feynman propagator of a particle coupled to any metric, E, a random metric, can be written as a type of path integral. This is called the word line formulation of phi theory. And it can be written as an integral over P, over lambda, and over X. The three P is a vector, X is a vector, and lambda is an intrinsic metric on the particle, where X0 is equal to X, X1 is equal to Y. And then, integral trace of pi ei of t plus or minus lambda over 2 p squared minus m squared. Okay, so that's how you insert. That's a general Feynman propagator for a scalar particle. Now, if I look at the Feynman graph, you know, coupled to an arbitrary metric here, then this object is the integral of all vertex, you know, of a product of Feynman propagator. So a product of all edges of the graph. And then the edge of the graph has an initial starting vertex and a terminal vertex. And I make the product of all Feynman propagator like that, which depends on my metric. And I integrate of all possible fluctuations in my space-time. I should put the proper metric here, square of g, if you want. Det of e, right? And this, well, if I use this word-line formalism, this is the same as the integral over all, p gamma, lambda gamma, dx gamma, exponential I, a certain action of a particle that depends on x gamma, p gamma, lambda gamma. And this action, so what I call x gamma, p gamma, is just a collection of x e for every edge of the graph. And if I call this object S of P lambda X, then this object is just the sum of all edges of S of X E P E lambda E. Okay. So that's the definition of a Feynman diagram in a one line coupled to an arbitrary metric. And now what I'm interested in is the effect of quantum gravity on the geometry, hence on how particles propagate in my space-time. So what I want to compute, is that better? Yeah. Is the integral over dE, the omega, you know, my Einstein action here, SE omega, 1 over LP, times my Feynman propagator, which depends on the metric. Okay? And this is, let's say, something like I tilde gamma of LP. Okay, so I'm interested into this observable. Let me call that an observable at this stage.
So this particle is defined by some word line, or?
No, what is defined is the Feynman integrals. Okay. So a phi theory, you know, an observable is not really a Feynman integral. What is an observable is always a summations over collections of Feynman integrals. Okay, so because it's a linear formula,
what
you can always write, you know, No, x has always the same meaning. X is just the position of along the world line of the particle.
Okay, so this world line of particle, and there is also a spin form. So what is the relation?
Well, at this stage there's no spin form. So this is in the continuum here, okay? So this is a very general. I want to compute the effect of the integral I take a Feynman integral, I couple it to the metric, I integrate the quantum gravity fluctuation of it. Okay, now I have the same problem as before. This is a formal integral, so I want to use my definition, which is my spin form definition.
What sense
is I gamma of E observable? At this stage, it's a gauge invariant, default invariant functional of the metric. Yeah, okay? And then, okay, yeah. And then, if you think in terms of phi theory, so in some sense, you know, the integral, a phi theory is what? A phi theory, if I start of an action, is a sum of all Feynman diagrams, of a collections of Feynman diagrams, or S matrix elements, or certain type of observables, you know, from the phi theory, I like that. So here, by summing a certain class of Feynman diagram, I can recover what happens to the initial phi theory coupled to gravity. Okay. So if I start from a phi theory coupled to gravity, and I look at the Feynman rules, I will get that. Okay. Yes. Feynman diagram. So a diagram, you know, Feynman diagram. You know what a Feynman diagram is? So gamma is a Feynman diagram. I'm sorry, maybe I should call it because, yeah, maybe. Yeah, okay, let's call it Aleph, Dalef. Okay, I should call it Dalef. You like Dalef? Okay. You're right, I mean, it's confusing. It's not, okay. Yeah, it has not, I'm sorry, it doesn't exactly have the same nature as Feynman diagram. In some sense, it's going to connect to spin foam. So if I have a Feynman Dalef diagram inside, and I have a boundary, you know, and here, let me take another color. You know, I have a boundary state here, which is represented by a spin network, okay? Then these boundary states in my geometry, this internal diagram is my matter, and then I need to have an extension of the notion spin network where I can couple these two things. This is possible in the kinematical setting and at the quantum level. So I have two type of diagram, one which is the matter diagram and one which is the boundary diagram. They are of different nature, they mean different things. In some deep level, they are just made of the same thing. Both of them are, in some sense, spin network of the Poincaré group, except of different representation. But I don't want to go there. But so that's the picture. For simplicity, I'm not going to consider this case where the interesting case where the Feynman diagram is coupled to the boundary and coupled to the boundary geometry. I'm just going to consider closed Feynman diagram, okay, for simplicity. So a Feynman diagram of a field theory is essentially just labeled, if it's just scalar field theory, just labeled by a mass, you know. And if more generally, it could be labeled by a mass, a spin, and a degree of, you know, special interaction. But let's say if I think of, I'm going to be very simple. It's a closed Feynman diagram, and it's a closed Feynman diagram of one massive, you know, scalar field theory. So from there, you can complicate the level of observable, you know, by looking at spinning, moving spin, et cetera, it's higher spin particles. So I'm simplifying closed and massive particle. So, okay, so now we have, we had the definition of this measure. So now I had the definition of quantum gravity. So I should be able to do the computation. In order to do the computation, I start from the same object. I start from my total action, which contains the gravity action plus a particle action, trace of xf, gf, plus an action for the particle. And the action for the particle is just going to mimic I have to discretize this action. I'm going to discretize in the simplest way, which just work. So at the discrete level, how are we going to discretize that? So the first thing is that I have to embed my Feynman diagram Dalef here into my spin foam model or into my triangulation. So I'm going to assume that the edges of Dalef are edges of the triangulation delta S, right? Or another way is that if you think about it, the edges of Dalef are going through the center of the faces of my spin foam, okay? So that's the configuration. I'm doing that because I know that to each face I assign this X, and I know that the Feynman diagram coupled to E, to the metric, so I have to put the Feynman diagram where I have put my metric there. And then the coupling is just going to be the sum of all edges of my Feynman diagram I take the xf pf plus lambda f over 2 pf square minus m square, okay. So that's my action. And the definition of my, sorry, all the, you know, the faces that touched my diagram here. So that's my action. And then I, okay, now everything is defined that my I tilde of, sorry, that F, which is the expectation value of I, is just going to be the integral of product df, dxf, dge, and then exponential s, exponential s of xf, ge, plus the particle action, which depends on pf and lambda f. And the integral is over xf, ge, dpf, and d lambda f. Okay, so that's definition. I don't have much choice here. And now you can ask, oh, but here there was an integration over x, okay, the world line of the particle. But the cute thing is that in gravity, if I, you know, take a Feynman diagram and I put it in some fixed place, and then I make a diffeomorphism, then I'm going to change the position of this Feynman diagram, right? So when I couple a Feynman diagram to gravity, I don't have really to do the integral over the all possible position of my world line, because if my action is diffeomorphism invariant, it will be automatically done, that is, by summing over all possible geometries. I'm summing over all possible fluctuations of the position of my particle inside. So you see that there's something kind of cute here, that you take this first, you know, quantized particle, that quantizing gravity and matter, you do it at once. You don't have to first quantize the matter and then quantize gravity coupled to this quantized matter, sorry. You have to do it, you know, in one stroke. Because, you know, fluctuating geometry and having something that goes inside is the same as, you know, fixing the geometry and fluctuating the trajectory. So it is the same thing. In some sense, you can't really distinguish matter and geometry in that case. You do it in one stroke. And that's why it's possible here. Because usually people have tried to quantize matter to a second quantized phi theory, where you already have quantized these things. And it's maybe it's doable, but it's too complicated. So here, the picture is simpler, I find. So here it's a Lie algebra. OK? I'm not assuming anything. D3 PF. OK, so it's a vector. Okay, I'm doing what I would do there. Locally, my geometry is flat. I'm discretizing. You know, I'm not assuming anything. But that's the good question, because the good question is, okay, if I now look at the equations of motion of this particle, and I vary x, f, sorry. Delta s over delta x, f, then I get that essentially the holonomy, you know, GF, which is the holonomy around the face here, is no longer equal to the identity, but it's proportional to PF. And then I have the constraint that PF square is proportional to the mass square. Okay? So I have a constraint that, this constraint is telling me that when I look at the holonomy there around the face, it's constrained to lie in a given conjugacy class. So what does that mean? It means that this equation implies so GF is a unitary matrix. I can always diagonalize unitary matrices. So it means that GF can be written as, you know, some group element UF. I'm going to H, okay, where HM is a diagonal matrix. Okay, and then the mass, which is here, is related to the parameter in my action. So the mass which appears here, m, is the deficit angle, right, that I see when I go around the particle. And it's the deficit angle. So this mass here, m, is the mass of my particle, m tilde, in unit of the Planck mass, time 4 pi g. Okay? And this mass here, this physical mass here, is related to my parameter in the action by a relation that so usually I call this object kappa. And sorry, maybe I should write it on the top, because I know that people can't see. Okay, so my equation of motion is telling me that classically what I'm doing is inserting not a flat geometry, but a geometry with a deficit angle, which is such that GF is of the form UF exponential IM 0, 0 exponential IM UF minus 1, and where the parameter big M, which is in my action, is related to my deficit angle, so that my parameter M is just the sine of the deficit angle. And I recall that M is, by definition, kappa, the physical mass, right? And kappa is 4 pi g. So you can think of M and this relation. If I do everything in Planck unit, then I have to kind of renormalize the parameter in my action in order to get the right physics. But when I do that, I've identified, you know, this new parameter here and related to the physics. And then
there's something in what you just said, but GF is in the group and PF is in the algebra.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So you're right that here, yeah, you're right that when I look at trace of delta GF, the equation is really that the projection on my Lie algebra of GF is equal to PF. Okay? Sorry. So for instance, you see that in some sense there, you know, I cannot have a mass which is bigger in Planck unit than one. You know, all momenta of my particle, or another way to see that is that all momenta PF that are bigger than the Planck scale, because this object is bounded by below the Planck scale, are completely irrelevant. They do not couple to the geometry. They don't see this geometry. They go through. They don't exist. Right? They're not there. So now I can start, and that's how the cutoff is implemented, let's say, in this theory. So this is another version that I have a discrete geometry, right? If I have a discrete geometry by duality, I should have a bound on the amount of resolution. You know, it's a bound on the resolution I have. But then if I try to propagate something in the discrete geometry, there's kind of a maximal frequency I can show. Of course, usually you put a sharp cutoff. So, but here, gravity seems to, you know, act as a sharp cutoff, but at the same time makes everything consistent. So also, the interaction is cut off. So that's not, it's not an approximation. It's really a real theory, consistent theory. So now I can, I mean, I've defined everything. I to gamma, I've defined, you know, this action. And then you can do, again, the same integration as before. I'm not going to do it, but integral over xf, you know, just impose this constraint, then you integrate over p, and then you expand the delta function, etc., etc. And what you show is that I tilde of gamma of del f is equal, okay? So there's nothing, I mean, all the technical steps you know already. I'm not repeating them. If I had more time, I would. But there's no mystery in what is now this. Okay, I'm just writing the results. So for each phase that do not belong to the Feynman diagram, well, it's just the usual weight. For each phase that intersect the Feynman diagram, there is some type of Feynman propagator that is going to arise. I'm going to explain what this is. And then at the vertex, I have my quantum geometry that is gluing everybody together, which is this object here. And what is this function, gm of g? Okay, it's just, it's not particularly enlightening, but if you think about it, exponential I dj of m plus I epsilon. Okay, so this is a function, and this function has two interesting properties. The first property is that this is essentially the usual Feynman propagator of 2 plus 1 gravity evaluated at a point x, which is LP times dj. Right. So this is like a sampling of my Feynman propagator at a discrete sets of distance. That's one of the first properties. The other property is that if I look, this is something which is labeled by this SU2 representation. And this is a scalar. So if I look at the Fourier transformation of that as a function on the group, the sum over G of chi m of G times the character of G. So let me recall you that if G is of the form x, h, m, x minus 1, then the character of G in the representation J is sinus dimension m over sinus m. Okay? So for dimension 2, it's just cosine theta, the usual one. So if I look at this Fourier transformation, this is a function of G, and you can show, it takes a while, but okay, this is a standard calculation, that this is this object, kappa squared, p squared of g, minus m squared, minus I epsilon. So this is so this object not only is like a Feynman propagator, but it is really a Feynman propagator if I use the Fourier transform. And I use here, you know, my projected momenta. There is this momenta which is bounded by Planck scale. Yeah, I'm going to conclude. I just have one thing. Okay. And as before, of course, I have to include, you know, a gauge fixing O of t, but it's the same thing, except that now this tree should not touch the Feynman diagram, because essentially what you're doing here is that you're viewing these degrees of freedom. You can interpret them. There's new degrees of freedom. You can interpret them as being previously gauged degrees of freedom that are becoming dynamical. Right? So the gauge fixing should not touch the Feynman diagram, because now they are real. They propagate. And the main result you can prove from there. So now you have a definition of these amplitudes there. And there's a very natural question. What I've done here is that to any Feynman diagram of a Skolopsky theory, I've given to you a number, definition. So you can wonder, OK, what is this number? Or what is what does it mean to look at the sum of a whole Feynman diagram of I tilde of gamma, you know, with some symmetry gamma coefficient and maybe a coupling constant which labeled the number of vertex of gamma, for instance. So is it possible to understand this object as coming from the Feynman diagrams of an effective phi theory? And the result is yes, is that in fact this Feynman diagram can be interpreted as the Feynman diagram's evaluation of a very specific effective phi theory. So this is the Feynman. Evaluation of a non-commutative mutative field theory. And I'm just saying two, you know, very rapidly what I mean by that, and then I'm done. Not going to show that in any way. This would take one or two lectures to really show it properly. But that's the summary. Essentially, what is a non-commutative phi theory? It's just a phi theory as where you choose an action, but when the fields are functions on a non-commutative space-time, so f of x, and you assume that the coordinates of your space-time do not commute, and the non-commutativity is of the form kappa xk, right? So coordinates do not commute. So this is a three-dimensional non-commutative space-time, if you want. And then you can show, starting from there, that if you look, for instance, at plane wave pg1.x1, so you can extend this, let's say, product, let me call it a star product, onto your plane wave, this non-commutative product here, pi, well, let me take pi x1 q, sorry, pi q.x. It also gives me another plane wave here, and there's a specific non-commutative addition of momenta that arise, which is that this is 1 over p squared q plus 1 over Q square P plus the cross product or the commutator P with Q, if you interpret P and Q as being Lie algebra elements. So it's a generalization of P plus Q equal P plus Q plus high order corrections in terms of kappa. And this defines for you, now that I have the definition of the non-commutative product on plane waves, because any field can be, expanded in terms of plane wave. I have a definition of this product on any field. The one of the key features of this product is that if P and Q are below a Planck scale, then P plus Q is again below Planck scale. So I have a covariant cutoff, but my addition of momenta respect this covariant cutoff. It doesn't go below. And now you can show that the Feynman diagram I was writing here is a Feynman diagram for a theory, which can be written as d mu phi star d mu phi plus sine mk kappa over kappa square phi star phi plus, if it's a, let's say, lambda, phi star phi star phi. So this is a non-local phi theory, because if you think about the star operation, it contains, on the field, it contains many, it's a star operation phi star psi, starts like a usual product, plus a bunch of derivative acting on phi and on psi and contracted and higher order derivation. So this is an effective action, a non-local effective action, but it becomes local in the star product. And you can show that it contains all the information that you have starting from the coupling of matter to 2 plus 1 gravity. So this is your effective phi theory and effective space-time, if you want, this non-commutative space-time.